This is an ABC podcast.
The vision of people when they set these colleges up was enormous. It's so very sad to see this coming to an end.
The last wave of students graduate from agricultural colleges in Queensland as they prepare to close their doors. And the remote Warrakoona community in Western Australia hold a ceremony for the family of two motorcyclists that died on country.
Family's got the feelings, we've got the feelings. We share the tears together with the family. And that's a good thing, but sharing with love and kindness.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Satellite imagery routinely used by the Murray-Darling Basin Authority has picked up farmers filling their private dams during a pumping ban. A pumping embargo was in place earlier in the year to allow some of the first flows from a cyclone to flow into the basin. The New South Wales Water Watchdog will investigate a number of farmers in drought-affected parts of New South Wales that fill their dams during the ban. Murray-Darling Basin Authority Chief Executive Philip Glyde told Gavin Coote the images of the full dams were picked up as part of routine monitoring.
Over the last couple of years, the Murray-Darling Basin Authority has been investigating the potential of satellite imagery to have a better understanding of how water moves around the landscape in the Murray-Darling Basin. And so this report simply reports on the latest stage of that. We did a similar report last year in relation to a flow that went down the Barwon-Darling River. This time there was a tropical cyclone in April. Water went into the Warrego, the Macquarie, and as a result of that, and this is long dry period, very dry up there, of course. And so we were monitoring how that water was going down through the river. At the time, the New South Wales government imposed an embargo between the 1st of April and the 7th of May. And so we were able to watch what happened to that water during both before, during and after that embargo period. And the logic of the embargo is that in a very dry time, the first flush of water that comes down a river is really quite important for the environment, but also for communities downstream. And so we were just monitoring that. And we noticed as we were going along that some of a lot of the private storages would fill up. You could see that from the satellite imagery. That satellite image doesn't provide a basis for knowing whether or not something's legal or illegal, but we referred those images off to the New South Wales regulator at the time, and this report simply is just documenting our sort of routine use of satellite imagery. And in this particular case, it happened to have some implications, possible implications for the New South Wales regulator.
Now, you've actually identified Macquarie, those three dams in the Macquarie, as a priority for investigation. Why were they identified?
Well, it just so happened that those particular ones filled up during the embargo period, and in theory, you would not expect those to fill up. Now, there may well have been good why they filled up. Theoretically, then you're not meant to be taking water out of the river, but they might have been from a groundwater source, or they might have been from another source of water that a farmer might have had on in another dam on their farm from a previous rain event. And so we've got no idea whether or not they're illegal or not, but that's why we refer those images off when we got them.
And if they do identify illegal activity, what sort of penalties can that watchdog impose?
Well, that's probably, I don't know the answer to that. That's really a question for the Natural Resource Access Regulator.
That's MDBA Chief Executive Philip Glyde speaking to Gavin Coote.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
While a five-day ceasefire begins today, the conflict between Turkey and Kurdish forces in northeast Syria has rattled Kurdish and Yazidi refugees in regional Queensland. There are now hundreds of families from the region living in Toowoomba, west of Brisbane, and many have family members affected by the conflict. As communication in the area remains patchy, they can only anxiously watch from their new home over 13,000 kilometres away. Nathan Morris has this story.
Khalid Ali has been in Australia for more than 2 years and is now working as a translator. He hasn't heard from his family in northern Syria for over a week.
I tried to call them yesterday. It was no connection, no network, so I'm still waiting.
Over the last few years, Toowoomba has settled thousands of Kurdish refugees from the Syrian war. Takdir Abdu's family were already displaced from the 2018 war Turkey waged on his region of Afrin, west of the current conflict.
They are affected by the Turkish army and other terrorist groups. Most of the people in Afrin or Rojava, they have nothing. They lost everything. Most people live in camps.
5 years ago, thousands of Kurdish Yazidis were trapped by Islamic State for weeks with limited food and water.
It was the Syrian Democratic Forces who rescued hundreds of the Yazidi families now living here in Toowoomba. But now they're the ones under attack from Turkey.
We support the YPG and YPJ and all the Rojava army because they saved us before. What's happening in the Rojava right now by Turkey is the worst crime in the world because many kids, women and people died for no reason.
The trauma is still being felt.
They saw like the worst things in the world. When you can, how could you say that someone killed in front of your eyes? Some of the people, they cannot forget.
The Toowoomba Kurdish community is calling on Australia's leaders to intervene.
I hope from the Australian government and all the government in the world to keep the Rojava people in safe.
And that was Nathan Morris with that story from Toowoomba.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. It's been seen as a big blow to agricultural education in Queensland, as this year's graduates from the Emerald and Longreach Agricultural Colleges will be the last. In light of that, our reporter Amy McCusker takes a look at the history of the colleges and what they've meant to agriculture in Queensland. Rosemary Champion has a long history with what became known as the Universities of the Outback because her father was one of the founders. And here she is speaking to Amy McCusker about the work that went on in getting the colleges off the ground.
And this was a result of a lot of lobbying and a lot of hard work from the local people that really believed that Longreach or Western Queensland deserved a University of the Outback, which, you know, back in the 60s, that was, you know, quite an ambitious program because we didn't really have a high school functioning even then, let alone jumping from a primary school, which everyone left school at year 8, to go very limited options and then suggest that we needed a University of the Outback. It was wonderful vision.
Jack Pizzi commissioned a report in the 1960s which found that young people were leaving school early, wanting to commence careers as jackaroos and gillaroos, but had limited skills and experience. The report advised that Queensland's first and at that time only agricultural training college in Gatton would struggle to service the number of prospective students based in regional areas and recommended the foundation of a number of agriculture-specific schools. Four schools were then founded to be funded and overseen by the Department of Education, starting in Longreach in 1967, followed by Emerald in 68, Burdekin in 1976, and Dalby in 79. And so began what many remember as the heyday of agricultural training in Queensland.
To have people come to the college wishing coming for an interview, and we would have parents coming with students, prospective students, to be interviewed for their course to be involved as a student at the college. And it was so pleasing to walk around and show them the different sections of the college. And it was just amazing to see the reaction of people to think that we had a college that could deliver the type of training that we were giving.
Bill Angus worked at both the Emerald and Longreach Ag Colleges for 30 years and says there was a time when the chance to study at the colleges was a hotly contested opportunity.
You know, we had a selection criteria. I mean, out of, say, for example, 5 interviews, you could only take 1 student, and that was the way it was.
According to former student and chairman of the Gulf Cattlemen's Association, Barry Hughes, the key was the practical-style training, which saw students running their own piggery and dairy, as well as learning how to break in horses, muster cattle, butcher meat, and grow crops. He said the practical training is a need that still exists.
The cattle industry is struggling at the moment in terms of attracting young people into our industry, sustaining them with a long-term career pathway. And I believe, you know, my experiences tell me as a past student that, you know, those colleges provided that career pathway.
Despite the ongoing industry support from people like Barry Hughes, the number of students attending the colleges began dropping. The last graduation will see less than 30 students graduate from each college, a stark contrast to a time when both institutions were flooded with applications. A 1997 report by a former chairman of the Longreach College, John Huesler, noted that drought and volatile commodity prices were reducing the number of jobs available to young people in the rural industries. He forecasted 20 years ago in his report that this trend was having a flow-on effect to college attendance. The 2018 Coldrec report cited growth in the university sector and rapidly developing technologies as reason the colleges were no longer fit for purpose. Whether it's just these reasons or others, Barry Hughes says he isn't sure, but he believes the government should have pushed on with residential training at the colleges.
Yeah, I still hold some anger towards a Labor government here in Queensland that made that decision based on I think, more of a financial issue rather than a long-term educational outlook for those people, those young people who have had their heart set in a career in agriculture.
In 2005, the colleges were amalgamated under the Australian Agricultural College Corporation. And then in 2014, the Queensland Agricultural Training Colleges took over as a statutory authority. Rosemary Champion says that this was the beginning of the end, as she sees it, as locals felt helpless to stop the deterioration of student numbers.
We had fell into this mass corporation, which we had no unique ability to have our own say. We didn't have any. We had no local directors, no local board.
As I mentioned earlier, the decision was finally made in 2018 by State Agriculture Minister Mark Ferner that the 2019 students would be the last cohort. A spokesperson for the QATC says it is anticipated that any gaps in training will be filled by a range of public and private registered training organisations, particularly TAFE Queensland and Central Queensland University. But Bill Angus says he can't see how the rural education space in Queensland will ever be the same.
The vision of people when they set these colleges up was enormous, to think that they were able to justify the colleges and have them, you know, deliver what they were delivering. But then it's so very sad to see this coming to an end.
And that was Bill Angus sending that story by Amy McCosker.
ABC Australia Wide.
I think it's wonderful. I think everyone should come and see it.
On ABC Radio.
Mining magnate Andrew Forrest faces a costly compensation bill after losing an appeal against a WA native title ruling over a huge tract of ore-rich Pilbara land. The land in question includes the multi-billion dollar Solomon Hub mine, belonging to Mr. Forrest's Fortescue Metals Group, or it's known as FMG. 2 years ago, the court granted a native title to 2,700 square kilometres of land north of Karajini National Park to the Yindjibandi people. FMG appealed the decision to grant exclusive native title to the group, citing concern about the higher standard of engagement with traditional owner groups required. Former Chief Executive Nev Power at the time said the federal court decision relating to the concept of exclusive possession has potentially wide-ranging implications for new investment in resources, agriculture and tourism. Now, FMG mine sits on Yindjibandi land, officially represented by the Yindjibandi Aboriginal Corporation. But an ongoing dispute over compensation has led to a bitter falling out between the mining company and leaders of the group. In a statement after the decision today, Fortescue's current CEO, Elizabeth Gaines, says, "We are aware of today's decision of the full federal court. We are considering our next steps, which may include an appeal to the High Court. The matter of compensation is an entirely separate matter, and our legal advice is consistent with our previous view that there's no material financial impact to Fortescue following today's decision. Our mining tenure rights and current operations are also unaffected." And that's news just in. In September, catastrophic bushfires ravaged properties in the Granite Belt, Queensland's cool climate country. It was an emotional hit in an area where farmers are battling drought and where the town of Stanthorpe is in the grips of a critical water shortage. Landline's Courtney Wilson went to Stanthorpe to see how the producers are getting on.
It is an historic event. We've never seen fire danger indices, fire danger ratings at this time of the year, as we're seeing now. I've never seen this before in recorded history.
In September, residents of Stanthorpe and Applethorpe were evacuated as bushfires engulfed more than 4,000 hectares over several days. winemaker and rural firefighter Ray Costanzo was one of many on the front line.
So dry, it's so tinder dry. Like, I was amazed at how quickly those tinders just started fires, and the embers coming down would just start other little fires.
Sam Costanzo has seen plenty of dry times on Golden Grove Estate. But in 72 years of farming here, this is a first.
How you going, Tim?
Good thing, how are you?
Not too bad.
It's a normal place.
With no water left on their property, the Costanzos are trucking it in to give their vineyard a much-needed drink.
This will get pumped up into the vines, give the vines a little bit of sustagen as they're starting to shoot out. We've never had to do this before. We've never run out of water here on Golden Grove.
Generally, the Costanzos make about 60,000 litres of wine a year, with a focus on alternative varieties.
We were just amazed that the vegetable growers around us last year cart in water to get through their season. We thought, well, imagine having to do that. And here we are, we have to do it ourselves.
At a cost of around $20,000 a megalitre, carting water is an expensive exercise.
Ultimately, it's only just to keep them alive. We're not really aiming for a crop at this stage. Worst case scenario is we have to mothball that vineyard just to make sure that those vines stay alive. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of investment there that we don't want to lose.
Horticulture is worth about $350 million for the Stanthorpe region. This area is significant on a national scale for producing a number of key crops, including apples, summer-grown tomatoes, capsicums and strawberries, and leafy greens. The extreme dry has put all that at risk.
Our truck is normally carting grain, that's what we do, but this year the grain tippers are sitting still and we're carting water. We do about 5 loads a day, 6 days a week roughly, and then we've been going since off and on since the 10th of January actually.
The logistics of trucking water in and around the region for months on end is mind-boggling. And so too is what it's meant for growers' bottom lines.
We spent close to $800,000 carting water. We carted around 85 megalitres over 165 days out of 167, stopping only for Christmas and Boxing Day.
The Granite Belt Growers Association recently commissioned research to try and gauge the actual financial impact of the drought. The results were alarming. A projected $60 million less in economic activity for the local region on things like fertiliser, diesel and machinery. And around a $40 million reduction in wages in the 2019-2020 financial year. Planning for the next drought, when you're in one, is something any good farmer knows needs to be done.
We've pulled out a third of our vineyard just to sort of compensate and going forward having more water for less vines as well. We desperately need some water infrastructure done up here.
On top of battling drought and recently also bushfires, the last thing this community needs is to also be fighting the false perception that it's not open for business.
There are big areas of Stanthorpe that are still producing fruit and veg in the coming season, and many tourist operators and many tourist attractions that are still well worth a visit.
Angus Ferrier finishing that report by Courtney Wilson. And you can watch the full Landline story this Sunday on ABC TV at 12:30 or anytime on ABC iView. It started off as a great adventure from one side of Australia to the other, from Steep Point in Western Australia to Byron Bay in New South Wales. A group of mates travelling through the outback on their motorbikes. Almost halfway there on a remote gravel road, one of the riders, Alastair Patterson, crashed his bike and was seriously injured. Despite the efforts of staff at the nearby remote community medical centre, he died that night. The next day, a second rider, Philip Jones, crashed his bike, passing travellers and other riders trying to keep him alive, but he died at the scene. These men died on Aboriginal country, on Warrakoona country, 340 k's from Uluru. So the local community invited family and friends of the riders to Warrakoona for a ceremony to take them home. It's believed to be the first time Aboriginal people have held this type of ceremony for non-Aboriginal people, and they allowed local police to film it. Here's a window into what happened. First, you'll hear from the community elder and educator Daisy Ward, and then you'll hear from the families of the men who died on the road.
Come on, Dorico.
The spirit is waiting, waiting, waiting. And that's why we got the families in, so they could take it back home. And then it automatically form into the body of the family and good for protection, to look after. Any danger, he's there, warning signs, like a guardian angel.
Coming today means that we can see where he was, see what happened, see how it affected other people, and really, I didn't realise how much it had affected the local community. So it's good for us to meet them and be able to thank them personally.
The respect that was shown from the Indigenous people and the effort that they put in, it just sort of made us realise that, you know, we're living in a society where there is tolerance and there is passion and there is commitment to the job, and people there genuinely trying to help each other out. It's been a tremendous experience for everybody.
Everybody has just got behind us.
Family's got the feelings, we've got the feelings. We share the tears together with the family. And that's a good thing, ba. Sharing with love and kindness.
Daisy Ward from the Warrakoona community near the border of the Northern Territory and Western Australia. And she was part of a ceremony organised for the family of two motorbike riders that died on her country. Now, next Friday, I'll be chatting to you not far from Warrakoona country, because Australia Wide will be coming to you live from Uluru and the closure of the climb. It's not uncommon for people to have backyard chooks, but now more and more people are putting beehives in their garden. Some are concerned about worried about the future of bees, and others just want to produce their own honey. Anthony Scully went along to a field bee day to meet some budding apiarists.
Yes, more and more and more. It's an exciting opportunity, and it's something that most people can gain the skills in doing, especially with a little bit of learning. And as I keep saying, do a course and you're well on your way. Lid goes back on and I'm done. Smoker's still going. I can move on to the next 100 colony.
We're just starting out. I just bought my first lot of boxes and smoker and stuff like that the other day.
And your motivation?
Just the interest of bees and you know, they're dying apparently, so the more people out there that breed them, the better off the world's going to be.
Yeah. Obviously, the side benefits of getting honey from bees, is that something you're interested in?
Oh, yeah,
as well?
Definitely. The honey's the bonus side of it, that's for sure, yeah. And I'm sort of semi-retired now too, so that's a hobby, an interest, something to keep brain cells ticking over, I suppose.
Yeah.
Robbie Ashurst.
And you've travelled from Sydney to Paterson here today.
I have indeed.
What's your interest in bees?
I love bees. Unfortunately, I'm anaphylactic to European honeybees, but I still go and have four hives of them, and I've got six hives of Australian native bees. Where before we had, you talk about chickens, and more people having backyard chickens, now more and more people are having backyard bees. Really has taken off, I'd say, in the last 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And I would have met at least five people today who they don't have their bees yet, but they're getting them in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Elizabeth Frost, Technical Specialist Honeybees.
So, Elizabeth, you are the New South Wales DPI Queen Bee.
Well, I think of myself more as a diligent worker bee amongst my other co-worker worker bees, and the general public want to know how they can help bees, and I would say it doesn't necessarily have to be keep bees or become a beekeeper. What we really need is for everybody to plant flowers, to know what flowers are native in their local area and attract bees. So everyone can help bees this season by planting a flowering plant, and specifically a native plant, because we have over 1,700 species of native bees as well. So what they feed on, honeybees feed on, and we can't breed a better bee that produces more honey if there's not nectar in the field to be collected.
Honeybee Development Officer Liz Frost speaking there to Anthony Scully in the Lower Honey Hunter, in the Lower Hunter Valley, not the Lower Honey Valley, but there's a lot of honey being produced there anyway. And that's a wrap for Australia Wide for this week. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely weekend. I'll speak to you again on Monday. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.